isn't what we say or think that defines us, but what we do. Jane Austen. This is the What We Do by Kira Kazantsev podcast. Hey everyone, I hope you didn't miss the podcast too much, but I've had a productive 2 weeks off, and thanks for all of your understanding and support in this time off that I've taken. But I'm so excited to get back to what we do with this week's guest. Maria Clave is a renowned computer scientist and mathematician. She's the former Dean of Engineering and Applied Science at Princeton University and is currently the first ever female president of Harvey Mudd College. Maria is a passionate advocate for women in STEM fields, and she has an incredible story to tell. Enjoy. Hi, Maria. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm honored to have you on What We Do.
It's really a pleasure to be here.
Good. You're definitely very different than anyone I've gotten to speak to. So I'm just thrilled and very, very excited.
Well, I'm excited to be here. And you're different from anyone who has ever interviewed me before. That is for sure.
Okay, good. Well, hopefully it goes well. So my first question for you is, I would love to just get a little bit of background about how you grew up, what led you to being so passionate about STEM fields, and what has kept that passion alive for all these years?
So I grew up being the second daughter out of a group of four daughters, and my parents expected to only have two kids. This is before birth control was really an effective thing. Yeah. and so I came along, and right from a very young age, I was my father's son. And, you know, it was just taken for granted by everybody that I was his son. We knew that technically I was female, but everything I was interested in was just boy stuff. And that was, you know, I was born in 1951. That's a time when life was still very gendered. And, I mean, much, much more so than now. And so as I was going through school, I think it was clear fairly early on that I really liked math. Wasn't the only thing I liked. I also really liked, I mean, I was crazy about reading. I mean, I would read like 14 books a week. We would go to the library and each of us could get out two books for a week. So that's eight. And then the adults, my parents, could get out three books. So that is another six. And I would basically pick all of the books, trying to pay attention to what my younger sisters, my older sister might be interested in. My parents, I didn't care about it. I'd get those books and I'd read all of them. And so that was, you know, I think I was doing that probably from the age of seven or eight or something like that. But it was pretty clear, I think, by the time I was 9 or 10, that math was something I really, really liked. And we moved from Edinburgh, Scotland to Edmonton, Alberta. I was born in Canada, but we moved to Scotland when I was four. And when I came back, it was really, really difficult culture shock because I was going from a girls' school to a co-ed school, and I had a very strong Scottish accent. We all did. And I got an enormous amount of teasing. And I think one of the things, I was so different from all the other students. And I just sort of, I think one of the things I just became comfortable with was that I was going to be very different from all the other students. And so, you know, when I was in 12th grade, I was the only girl in the advanced math class. And I was, you know, getting 100% on every test. And the class average was like 44. Miss Dodds, who is the math teacher for this class, she would say to boys, "Aren't you ashamed that you're getting beaten by a girl?" And, you know, I mean, it was just, and so, you know, from very, very early on, I felt like, okay, there should be more girls like me. Like, there should be more young women who really love math. I was very assertive, aggressive would be probably a more accurate description. You know, just...
Was that natural to you to have that character quality, or was it something that you developed as like a mechanism?
Sort of hard to tell, because when I was in Scotland, I was very introverted and had a close friend who was very introverted. And so I think it's something I had to develop when I got to Canada, because I remember having, you know, almost no friends, being 14 in 10th grade, and essentially deciding that I went to one of the popular girls in 11th grade who, you know, took the same school bus and just said, I need to figure out how to be popular. And she looked at me and she said, well, first of all, you have to start taking a shower every day. Because I was still, you know, in Scotland, you take a bath once a week. And I didn't like taking baths, so maybe I took a bath once every 2 weeks. And you wear exactly the same clothes every day. It's your school uniform. And so I was still doing that. So she's going like, well, you have to get different clothes. You have to get a haircut, a reasonable haircut. You have to, you know, actually take a shower every day. I mean, these are really, I mean, it's sort of amazing that she was willing to tell me these things. And I actually did. I mean, I just took her advice. And I mean, it was amazing. I came back from having gotten my haircut for the first time by like a professional person. And because, you know, before then we literally had these bowl cuts that my mother would give us. And I got asked out for a date that very same day. Like, it was just bizarre. You know, anyway, she gave me a lot of hints. And so I think, you know, I think at the beginning of 10th grade, I just decided, okay, I'm going to go for it because, you know, like it's, I mean, I was quite suicidal when I was 13 and I just, you know, so lonely and just so incredibly, you know, not fitting in with the culture. I mean, I was 12 and I was playing with, you know, boys who were 8 and 9 because I had no interest in, you know, clothes or music or boyfriends or any of those kinds of things. So as a conscious decision, you know, when I was 14, that I'm going to figure this out because it can't go on the way it is right now. And so I think after I did that, that I sort of just forgot about being afraid of stuff in some sense. So when I started university, I was going to do engineering because I thought it was a wonderful way to combine art and math.
You're an artist as well.
I've always been a very serious artist. And, you know, before I went to university, I thought very hard about whether I'd actually major in fine arts rather than engineering. But it just turned out that at that point, the math classes that were the best math classes, like the honors math classes, the most advanced ones, they didn't let engineering majors into them. And, I mean, now they would. But so I just decided that I'd switch to honors math just like that. And, you know, there were a very small number of, there were probably 2 women in honors math in my year. Now, maybe 3 out of between 20 and 30, because I can actually think of 2 other than me. And it was just a very strange experience in the sense, like, I loved the math, but I had always had this feeling that I needed to do something important in the world, something that would make a difference. And I couldn't figure out how I would do that with math. And so I dropped out of university in the middle of my 3rd year and ended up, you know, spending, I was gone for 21 months. And for 15 of those months, I was traveling with my boyfriend to India and back, which was just sort of part of, it wasn't that I wanted to do it. He wanted to do it. And I just sort of went along for the ride. And one of the things I discovered while I was traveling was I just couldn't live without math. It was just too important. And so I wrote to the math department where I'd been studying, the University of Alberta, and said, I'd like to come back and go straight into the PhD program. And, you know, I was really 2 years away from finishing my undergraduate degree because I left in the middle of the year and they were all year-long courses. So, and they were very nice and wrote back and said, well, we can't let you into the PhD program without you first finishing your bachelor's degree. And normally that would take you 2 years, but we'll give you a bachelor's degree if you complete the math courses you need, and we'll let you take the graduate math courses rather than the undergraduate ones. So essentially they let me come back and essentially go immediately into graduate work. And of course I had been out for almost 2 years and I had forgotten everything I knew, because I hadn't been doing any math, and math goes away if you don't do it, as we were talking about earlier. And so for the first time in my life, instead of math being just something that I didn't even think about, I mean, I always talked about math being like milkshakes. You know, they really taste wonderful. It goes down really easily. It's just like one of my favorite things in the world. And all of a sudden, math was really hard, because I was taking graduate courses without any of the prerequisite knowledge. And so I had to work. And so for the first time in my life, I actually studied. And it was totally transformative because when I had to work at it, it meant so much more to me. And so that was when I first started working hard, and I never stopped working hard. And while I was there, you know, they would say, you know, the profs would say things to me like, Maria, why do you want to be a mathematician? There are no good female mathematicians. And I would go like, I want to be a mathematician. Really, the fact that I'm female just doesn't matter. And I know what they were saying was not that I wasn't good at math, because everyone knew I was good at math, but they were saying, you're so talented in so many different ways, and almost anything would be an easier path to success than mathematics. My favorite class I took in graduate school was a class that had only 4 students in it, and it was combinatorics and discrete math class. And it was the first time I was ever in a class where getting the right answer wasn't enough. Like the prof who was teaching was a guy named John Moon. He graded it based on the beauty of your solution. And this, I'd never encountered this before. And all of us were, you know, like sort of very intimidated. And I don't think he'd ever had a female student in this class before. And he called all the men by their last name, but he didn't know what to call me. So he just referred to me as you. And one time there was a midterm and I arrived just on time, but everyone was there 10 minutes before and he kept on asking where I was. And the students were all playing really dumb, like, where's who?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I finished my PhD in mathematics and, you know, I knew while I was doing my PhD there were very few faculty positions available, and I wanted to be a math prof because I love teaching, I love research. And there were 83 jobs available in all of North America for people with a PhD in pure mathematics, and there were 1,000 people applying for them. And I applied, and I actually got, and those of those 83 jobs, probably less than 20 were actually tenure track faculty positions. So most of them were visiting positions of one sort or another, and I actually got one of the tenure track positions. I took it. My advisor, who was very young, he was only 6 years older than me, something like that. And, you know, I was his second PhD student, and he'd been very worried that he wouldn't have the connections to get me jobs. So he was so happy I got this tenure track job. And I went and I started, and it was at a university that's 25 miles north of Detroit called Oakland University. And I hated it. I mean, just like, I hated everything about it. I hated living 25 miles north of Detroit. I hated the fact that there was no social life. I hated the fact that the students couldn't add or subtract. And I was teaching them advanced calculus. You know, I mean, it was like, the whole thing was nutty. And so just by chance, so the way I dealt with that situation was that I went to a conference every month. Mm-hmm. And at one of those conferences, I found out that there were tons of jobs in computer science. And more importantly, that the people who worked in theoretical computer science did the kind of mathematical research that I really liked. And so I actually could be a professor in a computer science department. The only thing was I didn't know anything about computer science. And so I decided I would go back and get a second PhD. And so 1 year after I finished my math PhD, I'm at the University of Toronto starting taking, you know, 5 graduate courses per semester in computer science with no prerequisites. And it worked because I had done this once before. And I knew that if I just hung in there, even though I didn't understand a thing for several weeks, because, I mean, it was just all gobbledygook. And, you know, I ended up getting straight A's in my classes, and that the University of Toronto hired me as a faculty member, like, at the end of 10 months.
So you went to where the job was.
I went to where the job was. That's exactly right. And, you know, at the time, I felt enormous sorrow at leaving pure mathematics. And, you know, but it turned out to be one of the best things I did in my life, because it turned out that I got to spend my life in between the fields of mathematics and computer science, right at the interface, that because I went into computer science at a time when there weren't enough people going to computer science. So I was 28 when I got hired by the University of Toronto's computer science department. And so I was, which was about the time that most people are when they finish a PhD. So, you know, I wasn't any older than most of the people around. And so that meant that my entire career, there have not been enough people of my age in computer science. There weren't enough young people. Then when I became more senior, there weren't enough senior people. Then when I became very senior, there weren't enough very senior people. And I married, in my first couple of months at the University of Toronto, I met another theoretical computer scientist who was 4 years older than me. And we were engaged within 6 weeks, and we have now been married almost 38 years. Wow. And, you know, normally you have two people in the same field, and the chance of getting two positions at the same place is like zero. But if you're in computer science and started at that particular time, we've had jobs at the same place our entire career. Wow. So, I mean, so the fact that I made that switch, I mean, I think I actually had enough mathematical talent and certainly enough drive that I would have eventually gotten a job in a decent math department, even if I hadn't done it. But the fact that, you know, I learned the computer science was just such a plus. It's just amazing.
Ever wonder where you can get one of those awesome custom Snapchat geofilters? Or maybe you're thinking about starting your own podcast or lifestyle brand, but you don't know how to go about getting your logos and branding set up. Socialyte has you covered. Started by fierce female entrepreneur Alexa Rogers, Socialyte Design creates custom Snapchat geofilters, custom printables, logos, and can help make your wedding, bachelorette, birthday, or any event even more special. Lucky for you, she's offering What We Do listeners an awesome deal. Just use code WHATWEDO at sociallightdesign.etsy.com and all first-time clients will receive 10% off your first order. That's coupon code WHATWEDO at social, S-O-C-I-A-L, light, L-I-G-H-T, design.etsy.com. And you can check them out at Socialite Design on Instagram. Now back to the show. Why is it that so many women are proportionally, I believe the percentage is larger of women that receive PhDs to men in certain fields?
Yeah.
But then when you look at the percentages of women that hold senior, high-ranking faculty positions at prestigious universities, it's predominantly male. Right. So what's happening to those women in between? Where are they going?
Yeah, so the first thing I'll say is that, so, for example, women get about 30% of the math PhDs today and have for the last, let's say, 20 or 30 years. And yet, if you look at the top math departments, it's more like, I don't know, less than 10% of the women, of the faculty are female.
Okay.
And so I think there's a number of things that happen. You know, there's certainly, in some fields like biology and chemistry, if you get a PhD, you have to probably do 6 years of postdocs before you would get a faculty position at a research university, because we dramatically overproduce PhDs in biology and chemistry compared to the number of faculty positions that are available. And so if, you know, when you think about that, so being a graduate student is not a great time to have children. Being a postdoc, you're earning hardly anything. It's not a great time to have children. Being an assistant professor while you're waiting to get tenure is not a great time to have children. So I think a lot of women just sort of look at this and they go like, I'm going to take a job in industry. It pays better. There's better support, better parental leave policies, all of those kinds of things. So part of it is that people are leaving. But part of it also is that there's, I mean, I genuinely think that if you want a job as a faculty member at a place like Harvard or Princeton or Berkeley and you're female, you have to be significantly better than the average male who would get a job there. And it's a lot of it is just stereotype. You know, I mean, I'll never forget a really good friend of mine who was a math professor at Stanford at the time. And now he's a math professor at Princeton, and he's very talented and somebody I like a ton. But I remember him meeting a French female mathematician, and he said, I couldn't believe there was a mathematician who looked like that. She dressed so fashionably, and I mean, I just absolutely could not imagine that she could possibly do mathematics. So there's this really, this sort of, you know, there's this image of what, you know, what we expect people who are great something or others to be. And it happens in, you know, it's not just in academia. I mean, look at the tiny fraction of the directors, the screenwriters, the actors that are women. I mean, it's just crazy. And, you know, it's the same thing if you look in the media, you know, who most of the reporters are. If we look at the C-suite in industry, they're not there. If we look at finance, finance is even worse than the tech industry in terms of representation of women. So I think there's just a huge amount of, I don't know, you know, of women not being taken seriously. Like I remember, there's a very well-known theoretical computer scientist, Dick Karp, at Berkeley. And I love Dick Karp. He's just an amazing person. And the first time we ever worked together on a problem, he had come to visit IBM Research in San Jose, which is where I was working at the time. And after lunch, we started working on this problem together. And we didn't actually solve it. But, you know, we were just really working hard at it, exploring all, you know, going down the decision trees, trying to sort things out. And the next time my husband and I visited him, went up to Berkeley to visit him and give some talks there, we're walking, you know, down to the place we're going to go to lunch. And he says, Maria, I'm very embarrassed about the fact that I didn't take you seriously as a researcher. I'm going like, I didn't know that you didn't take me seriously. We spent several hours last week together working on something. He said, yeah, well, you know, before that, you're always so goofy and you're, you know, having so much fun. And, you know, like, I just didn't think you could possibly be a serious mathematician. And then I spent those hours with you and I could see you were. And I just feel terrible that I had made that assumption. Now, there aren't very many people who are as honest as and open as Dick Karp is, but that's, I think that happens all the time. And, you know, I can remember being my first theoretical computer science conference, and I was there with Nick. And this was like, you know, like three or four weeks after we met for the first time. Because he was a young superstar, all the top people were coming up and talking to him. And I would be listening and I would start to talk and people would tell me to shut up. Like just, I wasn't talking to you. Yes, but I'm listening and I have an idea. I wasn't talking to you. And it was just, so, you know, I think there's this thing going on that.
It's like a blatant disregard for intellect.
If you're female or if you're a person of color, if you're just anything, if you're gay, if you're anything different from the norm, there's an automatic assumption that many people have that you're just not really a contender.
And you think this persists today?
Oh, absolutely.
As well. So, what can be done about that for STEM fields and changing the perception of who is accepted and who is not?
Yeah. So, the first thing I think is the reason I'm at Harvey Mudd College rather than, you know, president of a large research university is that I came to the conclusion that probably the best lever we have for changing this is that in undergraduate education, because, you know, when you think about, and I focus primarily on STEM because that's my particular area, though I think there are similar issues in economics and philosophy and a number of other areas that are just as hostile is a strong word, but I would say in some ways those disciplines are hostile to women. And certainly in some cases, computer science and math are also hostile to women. But you can change that and you can change the way we educate our students at the undergraduate level so that they actually believe that everybody could be good if they work hard. And that it's not so much about natural ability. It's not what you're born with. So this is very much along the lines of Carol Dweck's work with the growth mindset. it's really more about your willingness to work hard, to persevere, to get help. And, you know, one of the things as I was growing up as a young mathematician that everyone sort of, that was often articulated is, you know, the people that are going to be good at math, you'll be able to tell because they learn math easily. And I was certainly an example of that. And now there's a realization that there will be some people who are very good at math who find it very difficult to learn. And they will persist. And then they will actually be able to discover new kinds of mathematics because they don't have the same wiring, maybe, mm-hmm. that they are bringing to the study of mathematics. So
they see it in a different way instead of right. the way it's been taught.
And so one of the things that we're really very serious about at Harvey Mudd is discovering how you make every student feel supported and engaged, encouraged. And how do we make them realize that it's okay to struggle? In fact, it's good to struggle. Almost everybody will struggle at something. And one of the greatest gifts you can give a human being is for them to understand that the fact that you had to struggle to learn it is not in any sense a measure of how far you will be able to get in learning. And the fact that it takes you longer, it just doesn't matter.
So what do you tell students that might struggle with like a math anxiety or feeling like they're not good enough and they fight this thing of, why am I here? How am I going to overcome this? It's almost like a mental health thing
right.
that comes with this really rigorous academia.
Well, I happen to feel like a failure the vast majority of days of my life. And it's definitely much worse since I had a head injury. So 1994, so, you know, 24 years ago now. But, you know, the single best thing you can do for anyone is to say, doesn't matter that you feel that way about yourself. Just ignore it. So yesterday afternoon, day before yesterday, Wednesday afternoon, I was meeting with a student whom I meet with about once a month. And you know, this is part of just encouraging. This is a student who is working really hard and is really struggling and feels constantly like he's not doing well enough. So we're having this discussion, and he's talking about how, you know, he desperately wants to go and get a PhD in, like, robotics or mechanical engineering. He's really, really worried that his GPA is not going to be good enough. And, and so we're sort of like, we're going around this thing, and I'm sort of like going, Felipe, it's really okay. Even if you don't get into grad school right when you finish at Mudd, you can take a couple more grad courses. You're going to get straight A's at any place other than the Mudd, and you're going to get into grad school. And, you know, I don't want to do that. I want to go directly. Why do I have to take this circuitous path? And we're having this, and I'm telling him about my circuitous path and so on. And then all of a sudden he says, wait a minute, I have something to tell you. I go, okay. And he goes, well, I've been taking this course, and there's only 6 students in it. And we're working on projects that come from this company called something like Audio Technica. It's not their name, but something like that. Anyhow.
The brand of my mic.
Oh, well, maybe it is Audio Technica.
This one.
Okay, maybe it is Audio Technica.
Audio Technica.
Okay, then probably it is Audio Technica.
This is a commercial for Audio Technica.
Yeah, right. Okay, so anyhow, so he's telling me this, and he said, and we were working on this design of something for them, the 6 of us, and they just told us that it's patentable and they're going to patent it.
Wow.
And I'm going, okay, Felipe, let's really think about this. Okay, in terms of getting into grad school and doing research, grades are like this. Patents are like this. There's no comparison. He goes, yeah, that's right. I mean, so, you know, this, I think a ton of people have this anxiety about all kinds of things, whether it's, you know, I mean, some people have it about public speaking, some people have it about math, some people have it about, you know, serving on a corporate board. I mean, just like any of these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So number one, no matter what it is, if you do it more often, it gets better, right?
Yeah.
So if you keep on learning math in spite of having math anxiety, eventually the math anxiety will not be the dominant thing that's in your mind. It will be something else. And you know, one of the great things in my life is that when I was 59, somebody signed me up for ski lessons without asking me. I have never really had ski lessons in my life. And I'm physically very uncoordinated. That has not stopped me from learning to juggle and ride a skateboard and various other kinds of things. But I hate taking lessons because I'm just such a slow learner and it's just embarrassing. So anyway, I'm in the first lesson with this, and it's one-on-one ski lesson. So like there's no place to hide. And I'm so nervous about the ski lesson that I can't even get my ski boots done up. And the instructor, who's like 8 years older than me, says, "You really don't want this lesson, do you?" And I said, "No, I really don't. So why are you doing it?" And I said, "Because Lenny signed me up and Lenny's just not worth arguing with." And, you know, so the first, he signed me up for 3 2-hour lessons 3 days in a row.
That's a lot. You're probably very sore.
No, I'm in pretty good shape. So that's, but.
Well, it's just painful.
It's just like, the first day it was exhausting. It was painful. And I was not doing very well. And the beginning of the second day, we're at the top of the ski hill. And Bob Duder, who's my instructor, says, "Maria, as you're coming out of a turn and about to start the next turn, just throw your weight a little bit downhill." And it went from being painful and awkward and impossible to, oh my God, I can actually do this. So for the last, I'm 66 now. So, you know, this is my 8th year of taking ski lessons with Bob Duder. And I have gone from being, you know, a crappy intermediate skier to being a good intermediate skier.
That's great.
It's amazing. And at my age too. So, you know, this whole thing about, you know, it's a perfect example of, you know, I have huge anxiety about learning to do things that require physical coordination. But I don't have to let that stop me from trying those things and becoming good at them.
I feel like you could probably very much empathize with your students in any anxieties that they feel. And you are the first female president of Harvey Mudd College since its founding in 1955, correct? So you, not only for the female students, are this incredible beacon of success and hope and light, but just for your students in general, you have the power to affect their lives and give them that empathy and tell them that it's okay. And what does that mean to you?
Well, you know, the biggest reason I love being, there are many reasons I love being at Harvey Mudd, and it's the best place I've ever been in terms of, you know, it's my favorite job ever. It's the highest quality institution I've ever been at in terms of commitment to do what we say we're going to do. And I think that the part that I love most about it is that I'm able to actually know individual students and faculty and mentor them and have that still be part of my life. And that's always been, you know, the reason I want to be at an educational institution has always been I love to work with students. I love to teach students. I love to do research with them. But most of all, I love to help them grow. And what I love about being at Harvey Mudd is I can be a president and I can do that. And I think it's also the reason that most of our faculty love being there because, you know, pretty much to a person, the people who work at Harvey Mudd work there because we care about the growth of our students. Yes, the growth in knowledge and skill, but also the growth of who they are as human beings and what they're going to do in the world. And it's just, it's an incredibly, it's such an incredible honor to be part of an institution that does that day in, day out.
You mentioned mentorship when you were going through your career and especially through school in the beginning stages. Did you have any female mentors?
I didn't have any female mentors. While I was in junior high school and in high school, I did have a music teacher who was female, Mrs. Brine, who was definitely a mentor. But I didn't have any female faculty. There were no women in the math department. I didn't take a course. I took one course in my entire time from a female math instructor, and she was a visitor. And I didn't particularly like that course. It had nothing to do with the fact that she was female. She was doing active learning, which was something I had never seen before and I thought was a total waste of time, which was making students get up and do problems on the blackboard and stuff like that. And I had no patience for that. So I didn't have any female mentors. think the first female mentor I really had was Martha Piper while I was a vice president at the University of British Columbia. She was the first female president there, and so far the only female who's been president at UBC. And I told her that I needed her to be my mentor. And her first reaction was, vice presidents don't need mentors. And she really believed that. And so I didn't argue with her at that particular meeting. But at the next meeting, I said, well, I'm going to tell you what I need you to mentor me on. I don't know how to schmooze. I don't know how to be in a room with 50 people and have a nice conversation that lasts 2 minutes and then move on. And I said, so I'm just going to false stalk you and watch how you do it. She said, okay.
So what does mentorship mean to you now that you're in a position to be the mentor? And how important is it for young female mathematicians or computer scientists or anyone in the STEM field to see their image reflected in their mentor?
So first of all, I think you can be mentored by people who are really different from you. And so I mentor a lot of people, everything from, you know, college students through fairly people who are pretty senior in their careers. And most of them are female, but not all of them. And, you know, some of them are people of color. And I think it's nice to be able to see somebody who seems similar to you in their personality, outlook, gender, sexual orientation, color, race, all those kinds of things. But I don't, if I had had to rely on having women as mentors, it would have been really hard. So I would essentially, when I would have difficult decisions, career decisions to make and so on, I would pick senior mathematicians in my field and I would ask them for 20 minutes of advice and just go up to them, and they would always, you know, they would listen and they would give you feedback. And you know, I think that that's actually a lot of the people I mentor who have approached me at some point and have asked me about things. And one of the things that's, because I love to paint, I often do mentoring phone calls while I'm painting. And that's just, I love doing that because I actually paint better when I'm talking to somebody about something. I learn as much from the people I mentor as they learn from me. And the way I sort of think about it is, essentially all you're doing is you're helping them analyze their situation and figure out what various paths they might have available to them. And you might be giving them advice that this one actually looks a little bit better than that one. But, you know, what I always say to people is, you know, it's your choice. I don't know you nearly as well as you know yourself. And so I'm not going to be offended if you ignore something that I think is a good idea, because it might not be a good idea. And often just that possibility of talking things through with another person who's not judging you, who believes you're going to be successful, it makes a huge difference.
So obviously not every high schooler in America can call you and have that opportunity. So if someone out there is listening, maybe it's a young girl in an at-risk community, she's passionate about STEM, but she feels like she can't measure up or she's afraid to apply to a school, what is your advice to that girl?
The first thing is, if you're in a situation where you feel like you don't have, well, let me back off for a minute. Let me list the kinds of people who might be able to give you good advice. So first of all, often your teachers will. And not every teacher is encouraging. So definitely don't talk to the ones that aren't, but talk to the ones that are. And similarly, it's often very helpful to talk to your friends, you know, sort of to make a pact with your friends that I will be your cheerleader if you will be my cheerleader. And, you know, because it's almost always the case that two heads are better than one, and often four heads are even better than two. And so having a dialogue with anyone who has, you know, similar concerns and similar aspirations can be really helpful. So that's one thing. The second thing I'll say is that they're actually, so for example, I think many people who might come from a low-income family don't realize that, in fact, it could be much less expensive to go to a private institution than to go even to a community college, because many private institutions are need-blind and, you know, will will pay for everything if you really come from a low-income family. And also, it's often the case that almost all institutions charge an application fee, but they will, in fact, waive it if you ask them to waive it. So in most communities, there are, particularly if you're interested in STEM, there are some programs for underserved, for, you know, young people, young women, young men in underserved communities that are very deliberately there to give you the possibility of experiencing what it might be like. So, for instance, there's a program called BEAM, that stands for Bridge to Enter Advanced Mass, that was started in New York City, and now there's a version of BEAM in Los Angeles as well. And the whole idea is to take students who would never imagine that they might actually be interested in maths, but in fact do have some ability, and just give them a summer program that lets them see what's possible. And then typically what happens after that is that the BEAM organization stays in touch with the students as they go through middle school and high school, and even as they apply to college. So there's just a lot of opportunities for getting advice from organizations that really want to help people. The other thing I will say is sometimes your relatives can be really good. It's interesting to me at family weekend, which is when the families of our students come to visit. At one point, we had a first-year student from a Hispanic family, and his parents came up and they said, "You not only have changed his life, you've changed our lives, and you've changed his grandparents' lives, because you've made it obvious that there are things that members of our community can do that we didn't realize were possible." And so, you know, I don't want to say that it's easy for someone who's gone to, you know, a not so great high school, which is the way I would describe 99% of the high schools in the U.S., it's pretty challenging to go from that to a place like MUD or Stanford or MIT or whatever, or Caltech. But there are people who do it and who succeed. In fact, the vast majority of people, you know, if I look at the students who attend MUD, about more than half come from public schools. And we're now like 20% Latinx, 31% Caucasian, 5% Black, 10% international, 20% Asian, and 15% multiracial. I mean, so we're now a very racially diverse place. And I don't want to say that we've gotten it perfect at this point. We definitely haven't, but we're getting better. And yeah, so, you know, I think the thing is that sometimes the hardest thing to do when you doubt yourself is to actually just take the first few steps of applying someplace, asking questions, asking for help. But then if you do those things, you'll often be surprised at just how much help you will get.
So you mentioned that BEAM program, and earlier we were talking about K-12 education and feeling not encouraged if you're not one of those students that just automatically stands out as a stellar math student. So I think it's really important to know that there are other resources outside of just your school. There's all these types of programs. And if you don't feel like you're excelling in a particular math or science area, that's okay. You still might have a very unique perspective to bring.
Absolutely.
So what can K-12 educators do to encourage that notion of, you know, just because I am not naturally gifted in this area doesn't mean that I can't be phenomenal at it in the future?
Well, I think it's a mindset thing. I really do. I mean, I think it's, so from my perspective, every teacher should be encouraging every student, whether they find it difficult, you know, whether they're the weakest student in the class or the strongest student in the class, they can all get better. And the weakest student in the class, you know, this year, you know, starting out this year, could turn out to be a very strong student a year or two later if they're given the encouragement. And it's just so often the experience that you have in middle school or high school is so different from what you will actually have if you ever become a professional working in a field. And so deciding that you're not good at something because you didn't do well the first few times you had classes in that subject, it's not a good predictor.
Now that you've had all of this experience with these students as the president of Harvey Mudd, what would you say has been your biggest lesson taken from it as an educator yourself and some of the biggest challenges that you've overcome?
Biggest lesson? Well, I think one of the really big lessons is, and I hadn't even thought about this for myself, is if you are a person, if you're an underrepresented group doing anything, you're less likely to ask for help because you already feel vulnerable because you're female, you're gay, you're Black, whatever. And the fact that you feel vulnerable makes you much less willing to reach out and ask for help because it will make you feel more vulnerable. And so learning to, and, you know, I didn't, it wasn't until I saw students doing this and then I reflected on it myself how bad I had been at asking for help, how reluctant I had been throughout my career to ask for help. And so I really learned that from watching our students. And so that's definitely, I think, the biggest thing I've learned through this experience. The most challenging thing has been dealing with student deaths. We have had 2 students die in car accidents while I've been president, and 1 student die from an opioid overdose. So that's 3 students in almost 12 years. And I just can't say how hard it is because we are such a tight-knit community and there's just no way to easily get past the fact that we have lost somebody that we really cherish. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword because obviously the reason that I love being there and that our students love being there is because we're a very tight-knit community and we all know and care for each other and help each other and all those kinds of things. But when somebody actually dies, it is just, there's just no word for the depth of grief and sorrow.
I mean, I can't imagine because you probably see a lot of these kids. These are like your kids.
They're like my kids,
your responsibility. And as the president of a college, you not only get to enjoy all the success, but you have to internalize all of the grief and the criticism that comes with it. So, I mean, I think that those kids are so lucky to have you, to have somebody that truly, truly cares. You know, if I could be an undergrad again, I think that would have really changed how my perspective on college was and how learning was. I just think it's so important to have somebody in your life that can see you for the talented student that you are.
Well, and the thing about Harvey Mudd College, it's not me that makes the difference as president. It is the fact that our entire faculty and staff feel that way about our students. So it's not, I mean, it's something that we all bring to work every single day. And, you know, it's just so interesting talking to parents of first-year students, and they'll sort of say, well, they say that everyone helps them. I'm going, yeah, that's what we do. The students help each other. I mean, it's our student value is that it's every student's responsibility to help every other student succeed.
Oh, wow.
So it's a culture that is, you know, like runs absolutely through the college, and that's the culture that makes me love being president there.
So you said, that's what we do. It's the name of my show.
Yes.
What We Do podcast. So I will ask you one more question and then I know you have to run. So I always like to ask in terms of what you do and what you've continued to be able to do, has there been a catalyst moment throughout your entire career when you look back and that really propelled you to the next stage and gave you the confidence that you needed to be that individual you are today?
I don't think it gave me the confidence, but it changed the trajectory of my life. So I had a very good friend whose name was Anita Borg. And we met each other first in 1984. We didn't really get to know each other until 1990, get to know each other really well. But then we became very good friends. And around 1997, Anita decided that, so she was a top computer systems researcher, but she had been, like me, cared a lot about getting more women into technology careers. And she decided that she was going to change the direction of her life to focus on women and supporting women in technology careers instead of working on the next computer systems project. And she started something called the Institute for Women in Technology in 1997. I was one of the first two trustees on the board of it. And in, I guess, 2000, Anita was diagnosed with brain cancer, glioblastoma. That's almost always fatal. She lived for about 3 years after she was diagnosed. And I think one of the things that happened to me in dealing with the fact that I was there was this amazing person in the world who was going to die, was it made me, I think, be much more intentional about that I was going to focus on issues of diversity, inclusion, and STEM as the primary thing I was going to do with my career, rather than, you know, being a mathematician and computer scientist. And I had already moved into academic administration, but it was really watching Anita die that caused me to decide that I would move back to the U.S. and go to Princeton University at the time, because what I realized was that the kinds of things we were accomplishing in Canada were not going to have any impact on culture in the U.S. because the U.S. is basically blind to Canada, and that if I wanted to actually have more impact, I had to be at a place where one could actually accomplish change and have it be seen. And, you know, I was at Princeton for 3.5 years. There are many ways in which that was a really good experience, particularly the strategic planning we did for the engineering school and how long that strategic plan influenced the engineering school and the methodology we created and so on. But I came to the conclusion that I would actually have more impact at a place like Harvey Mudd, because I thought the faculty were more innovative in terms of pedagogy and curriculum, and that that's what was really needed to get more women into areas like physics and computer science and engineering and so on. And that turned out to be, you know, I would not be where I am today if Anita were still alive. We are seeing change today, not just in places like Harvey Mudd, but there's a number of other universities we're working closely with on attracting more women and people of color to computer science. And, you know, I do feel like we're gathering momentum and that we will, within my lifetime, see participation by women in computer science dramatically increase.
Well, I look forward to seeing that as well. And maybe I should take a computer science class.
Yes, you definitely should.
I think I'm going to do that. I need that.
Yeah, yeah. Stanford's 105 is pretty good.
Okay.
105A.
Okay, I'll look into it. Maria, thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and I can't wait to share this with all our listeners.
It's been super fun getting to know you, talking with you, and hearing your story as well. So thank you.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks for listening. Tune in every Wednesday for the latest episode of the What We Do by Kira Kazantsev podcast. Follow at Kira Kazantsev and at What We Do Podcast on Instagram for the latest podcast updates, or go to whatwedo.live or whatwedopodcast.com for our blog, bonus content, and info. Questions? Email us at info@whatwedo.live. See you next week. What We Do by Kira Kazantsev is mixed and mastered by Resonate Recordings. Interested in starting your own podcast? As a What We Do listener, you can go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free. Just let them know we sent you. If you have a podcast or are considering starting one, I can't recommend them enough. They are amazing audio engineers that understand podcasting like no one else. Go to resonaterecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free today.